Explaining kyudo can be quite tricky as it depends on what it means to, each person. They take it a different way. However, in essence, it's using a bow and arrow to shoot targets which are 28 meters away. So it's Japan's traditional archery taken into a modern setting. So that's when it becomes the do. So after the Meiji Restoration and war and everything had subsided, it was made into a do, so kyudo. Kyu means bow, so the way of the bow, or just looking after ourselves. And it's quite an introspective thing. It's also a sport, so people do competitions, and it's a mix of a lot of different things. So it's very like in with yourself, and it's a community, and it's very tricky to explain. However, it's fun. However, there is a large sort of stereotype that it's like Zen archery. I have a few feelings about it. However, it's not everything, and it's not all about Zen and standing meditation and that kind of thing, as you can imagine. So, but yes, it's come from that Meiji Restoration. It has its roots in samurai archery and horseback archery, the shape of the bow, and it's very fun.
This is Nick Kemp with the Ikigai Podcast, Japanese wisdom for a fulfilling and meaningful life. Find your Ikigai at ikigaitribe.com. My guest today is Jessica Geraghty. Jessica, you moved to Japan over 20 years ago from New Zealand without knowing any Japanese. And after learning the language from watching TV, it wasn't long before you found yourself working as a TV personality, writer, and tourism ambassador for Saitama Prefecture. And I think all that's amazing.
Thank you.
You're also a mother of three, and you also have and run your own dojo for kyudo, which is a form of Japanese archery. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Yes, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's my pleasure too. So you've been under my interview radar for quite some time, and a few of my community members suggested you as a guest, so I'm really happy to have you on today. And I think the reminder for me to reach out to you was one of your LinkedIn posts where you wrote how kyudo is your ikigai, something that positively impacts your life, and that's what we'll talk about today. But before we do, I've got to ask you this question. Do you pinch yourself every now and then thinking, how did I end up living this, amazing, crazy life in Japan?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's not really amazing and crazy. I think probably for the outside world looking in, it may seem amazing and crazy, but this is my nichijo. So this is my everyday life. And just being a mom of, three kids is the main thing. The thing about social media is I post a lot of my different activities that I do. So to a large extent, without children being posted up on there, it's kind of difficult to get a look at the realities of the everyday. But it is a really wonderful and fun life and enjoyable, tiring, challenging. However, yeah, it's definitely a super amazing life, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you're really good with your content and you seem to have so much of it. So there is this impression I have of you that, gee, you must be so busy running around being filmed everywhere and practicing kyudo and all these other martial arts. But I guess, yeah, at the end of the day, we're also parents and we have all these things no one sees.
Yeah, that's right.
But I was reflecting on your life in Japan, and I'd probably ask this sort of question maybe at the end of the podcast, but do you think you found yourself in Japan, or do you think you created or self-actualized like a new Jessica? One that would never have come into being if you had only lived in New Zealand?
I don't know. I've never really thought about it until you asked me the question. So I kind of just go with the flow. I'm a person that does like to plan things out before I go ahead and do them. I don't like having no plan. However, moving to Japan, I was freshly graduated from a master's degree. So thinking back then, this is before the advent of social media and people discovering themselves, so early on, I was just a university student and I hadn't really thought about self-discovery as such. However, for a lot of us Australians and New Zealanders, we have our overseas experience where this is our chance to, you know, maybe we've finished uni or we're taking a year off and we go overseas to kind of do our OA and try something different. And that's a bit of a self-discovery and that kind of thing. That was sort of not, how can I say, I didn't really have that in my mind of what mm-hmm. I wanted to do. Therefore, I will move to Japan. It was just, I had been visiting Japan once a year since I started university, and I thought it looked like a really amazing place to live. I hadn't really given much thought to the language barrier or cultural barriers or anything like that. How would it all work out? Like, people say it's such a big jump from New Zealand to Japan, culturally, and, you know, the language and everything. Weren't you like worried or scared or whatever? And I had a job lined up. I had a visa. I had a place to live. I think the basic necessities of life were sort of sorted there. It wasn't this thing like I was on a journey of self-discovery, or it was really like a 20-year-old's kind of thing. I'll just give it a go, try teaching English over there and see what it's like. And then, yeah, I never came back. So it was just an adventure, and I kind of just followed it naturally, and that's how everything sort of turned out. Didn't really answer your question, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Yeah, I mean, when I first went to Japan, it was for a traineeship, cooking traineeship. And yeah, you know, that was just because I wanted to go to Japan. It wasn't because I wanted to, you know, self-actualize. But I think sort of in the process of living in Japan, it obviously defined me in some ways, and I learned different perspectives. And so I'd probably be a different Nick had I just stayed in Australia. And I lived in Japan on and off 10 years.
Okay.
And you've lived there for 22. So that's
getting up there.
A significant amount of time. But before we dive into Kyoto, would you like to touch on these various roles you have as a TV personality and writer and ambassador for Saitama Prefecture?
Yeah, so I have been on Japanese TV for about 16 or so years. And how can I say, I think it's a bit different to other countries' TV shows, where in Japan you have people from different countries introducing different things about their own country. So in my case, it was New Zealand. And it was just a really nice chance to, you know, use my Japanese to meet other people, a really different environment. However, thinking back, actually, when I was little, I've always done speech and drama. So I've always been in like stage performances and in theatre and this kind of thing. So thinking back, I probably did have some sort of something locked away within my my body and my mind that was sort of like, this is not, you know, such a big jump for me. It wasn't a really big jump for me to be on in front of a camera and speaking to people. However, I do get nervous, but it was more like, am I going to screw up my Japanese more than the actual job itself? And it's very interesting. It's provided me a lot of insight into the way that media and entertainment works in Japan. It's very rigid, very structured. The different processes that they have, the way everything is very controlled, not in the sense of like political and this kind of thing. So I won't get into that. However, more in the sense of people that work for talent, you know, Japanese talent agencies, and the way that their working style and how controlled the, you know, the idol or the talent is. As many people know, if they watch on social media, the idol's life or the talent's life, who are Japanese people, are quite, it's quite a hard life, and they work very, very hard. Yeah, so I got a lot of insight working in that industry. And then the other thing I do is I write for several different magazines and sort of online sites. So I write in English and Japanese, depending on the publication. And that's really, really nice. Usually it's about Kyudo or martial arts. And the other thing I do is I am the ambassador for Saitama Prefecture's tourism and sort of PR. And it started quite a while back, maybe about 5 years ago. And yeah, I visit different craftspeople in the Saitama area. Saitama is where I live, so north of Tokyo. And different tourist spots, this kind of thing. Of course, we did have the pandemic. So at that time, there was no tourism in and out of Japan for a good couple of years, and that sort of put a stop to quite a lot of the activities that I was doing. However, I have started up again recently. I visited a tatami craftsman who is a really fabulous guy. And it's just showing people nice things about Saitama, and it's the area where I live. So for me, it's a bit of ongaishi, we can say, which is giving payback. So like in a good way, giving things back to the community that you are part of. So I've lived in Saitama for about 16 years. So for me, it's sort of natural in a way to give something back to the area that I live in.
Hey there, Nick Kemp here, and I wanted to touch base and let you know about my new course, the Find Your Ikigai course. Developed in consultation with Japan's leading Ikigai researchers, the Find Your Ikigai course is the only culturally accurate and evidence-based practical guide to the Ikigai concept. If you are interested in learning more about the Find Your Ikigai course, please visit ikigaitribe.com. Now back to the episode. Sounds wonderful. I'd certainly love to explore craftsmanship in Japan. My father-in-law in Japan makes pottery. He makes machijawan and he makes shinoyaki, so a unique type of pottery. And yeah, it's just fascinating how dedicated craftsmen are to their craft and the lengths they go to satisfy their customers. Yes. And yeah, truly fascinating. Now, in addition to all of that, you're also a mother of three young children. So that must keep you busy. Would you like to share anything about that?
Yes. So I have three children, and my eldest is 15, the second one is 12, and the youngest is 9, which sounds quite old. So everybody's becoming a little bit more independent, and they're not that small anymore, which is great. My youngest, however, was born with congenital. She has special needs. So she has physical and intellectual disability. So at the moment, as a 9-year-old, she's sort of the size of about a 5-year-old, I think. And she needs help to eat and, you know, to be like diapered or to have nappies, and she has to be put in the bath and this kind of thing. So it's essentially like having a baby that never grows up in the terms of the physical needs for the parent, what they have to do to look after the child. However, she is getting bigger and heavier. So carrying her is like, it's really getting really hard work. However, that's where the kudo comes in. So it's sort of a good balance and weight training for there. So I do have this kind of unique sort of situation at home where it's very difficult to do a full-time job or full-time work just because she has rehabilitation needs like physical therapy and this kind of thing, and then having her school bus coming, dropping her off at school every day and that kind of thing would make commuting to work very difficult. So I am the parent who is in charge of that side of it. My husband is Japanese and he's very, how can we say, like a very typical Japanese guy. He's very hands-off. I won't say typical Japanese guy because not all Japanese men are like this, people, in case you're listening. The younger generation of people seem to be a lot more hands-on. His father was very hands-off. So he's learned and grown up, not to give excuses, but he's learned and grown up in an environment where the male plays this breadwinner role and the mother is situated at home and doing just mothering and housewifing, a stay-at-home mother. So he's grown up with that. And I've grown up with a mother who has worked full-time. She is a refugee center, like director, and my father who is a marine engineer. So grown up with these two really strong role models, independent and working. So as you can imagine, it's quite an interesting relationship. However, so I do like to keep that balance of working to have my own self-identity and who I am as a woman and a person in the world. And I do try to make priority, of course, for my children, especially my special needs child. So, yes, I have a lot sort of happening and going on.
Well, thank you for sharing all that. And
oversharing.
You actually reminded me of this memory I have. It was Oshogatsu, and my father-in-law's the oldest son in the family. So everyone comes to the family home, and, yeah, I just would be just shocked every year that you've got all the men sitting down eating, drinking beer, you know, watching the marathon. And all the women are in the kitchen. And I remember my brother-in-law just yelled out to his wife, like, "Biru." And I was like, hey, Takedo, come on, mate. You know, get up and get your own beer. Yeah. It was just ridiculous. So, yeah.
This is literally what it's like. It's not all Japanese families as you gather, but it depends. Honestly, like the older generation, they are quite We will call it Tesh Kampaku for the word to describe a Japanese man. So very set in his ways and kind of chauvinistic. However, little by little, they seem to be softening up a bit, which is nice. And I do see very older gentlemen, looks like the grandfather, Oji-chan, and he's pushing the stroller or the pram with their grandchild in it. So I like that they're taking another look at, you know, helping out for child raising as they're retired, which is kind of cool. Yeah.
That is cool. Well, let's dive into this love you have for kudo.
Yes.
So would you like to explain kudo and then maybe also touch on specifically do? Yeah.
Explaining kudo can be quite tricky as it depends on what it means to, you know, each person, they take it a different way. However, in essence, it's using a bow and arrow to shoot targets which are 28 meters away. So it's Japan's traditional archery taken into a modern setting. So that's when it becomes the do. So after the Meiji Restoration and war and everything had subsided, it was made into a do. So kudo. Kyu means bow. So the way of the bow. Or how can we say? Just looking after ourselves and self. It's quite an introspective thing. It's also a sport, so people do competitions, and it's a mix of a lot of different things. So it's very like in with yourself, and it's a community, and it's very tricky to explain. However, it's fun. However, there is a large sort of stereotype that it's like Zen archery. Mm-hmm. So for thanks to the book Yumi and Zen, which is after I just say this little piece, but Yumi and Zen, I have a few feelings about it. However, it's not everything, and it's not all about Zen and standing meditation and that kind of thing, as you okay. can imagine. So, but yes, it's come from that Meiji Restoration. It has its roots in samurai archery and horseback archery, the shape of the bow, and it's very fun.
Looks like fun, and we'll get into all those things you discussed. And I think I mentioned to you in my notes, I watched a documentary called One Shot, One Life, and that explored several aspects of kudo, even touching on its connection to Chinese archery and Confucianism. And that was really fascinating. But there's this wonderful NHK video of you explaining, I guess, what we'd call the eight movements of kudo, which is hasetsu.
Yes.
So it might be hard for our listeners to visualize, but would you like to briefly touch on those eight movements and why they're important and how they make the practice of kudo what it is, I guess?
Yes, and actually in this, it is eight movements, so we can say they're like the kata, if it's someone who's familiar with karate or other martial arts. Other martial arts have kata as well, so you have these different positions from starting until releasing the arrow and then the end, the way your position is at the end of your shooting and bringing the bow back down. So in essence, it's one movement. However, to break it down, it's eight kata. But inside those kata, there are several other small things that need to be done. So the eight movements, or the hasetsu, are necessary in my school of archery to be able to pass grading and to be able to shoot the bow. You need to be doing these eight kata in the correct sequence in order to shoot the arrow. So if these kata are correct, without going into big details about each of them, if they're correct and performed technically correct, you'll hit the target with your arrow. So if you have a bit of an unbalance somewhere, in kudo it's about a millimeter, I think. If you're off in some direction with your hands or your body, then it translates to a 10 centimeter or more difference in the arrow placement at the target, which is 28 meters away. Yeah, so it's just very tiny micro movements that make these huge changes over where the arrow shoots. So, but the hasets are necessary to be performed correctly in order to have the correct technique and also to get the arrow to fly correctly. Yes.
Yeah, it almost looks like ceremonial archery. And when people have images of archery, maybe they're thinking of something like Legolas, you know, from Lord of the Rings quickly firing several arrows out. Yeah. Or, you know, modern archery with these compound bows and sights and all those things.
Yeah.
But, yeah, obviously Kudo is quite unique in, I think, in all aspects of the sport or the craft, with the length of the bow and I guess the purpose behind the sport. One other term I discovered from that NHK video was te no uchi. I love learning. So would you like to touch on te no uchi?
Okay, yeah. So te no uchi is, te is Japanese for hand, and no is the possessive particle. So your hands inside. So uchi is some uchigawa, and uchiki being introverted, or uchi is a nice kanji. It's very interesting. So te no uchi is the inside of your hand, and it's a technique to hold the bow. The thing with the Japanese bow is that if the hand technique is not correct, the bow won't turn in your hand. So the string, when you let go, the string turns until the back side of your hand. You won't hit your ear and you won't hit your arm, or it's quite different to Western style Olympic archery. So the bow turns in our hands, and to be able to give the correct pressure and force needed to be able to perform this, the te no uchi is very important. And a lot of people say it takes a lifetime to perfect the te no uchi. Yes, I'm constantly trying to improve it, because mine, without even thinking about it, it seems to open up a little bit as the bow. This is just recently. Mm-hmm. It seems to open up a little bit. I take videos of myself, and the reason is to check my technique. They do get posted on social media, but it's not to show off. It's a lot of the time it's to check my angles and my technique. So I do zoom in on my te no uchi, and I'm always like, because it looks really horrible. And I get messages. Honestly, I get messages saying, like, your te no uchi is so bad.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yes. But te no uchi is it's that hand technique. And the thing was that there are other te no uchis in martial arts. So I do naginata as well. There's a te no uchi for naginata and for iai, the sword art with the katana, te no uchi. There's te no uchis for many different things. And I've been learning a bit about samurai etiquette recently, which is reho. And there's a te no uchi for when you're holding things. So there's just a te no uchi in all different aspects of life, when you're interacting with other people, when you're with yourself. The correct way to hold your hands, the angle and everything like that, denotes different meanings to the person who is on the receiving end.
I see.
So it's very, yeah, the concept of te no uchi is very interesting. And it's not just for kudo, but diving a little bit more deeply into te no uchi, it's given me a lot of insight. But yeah, te no uchi is cool.
It is cool. And when I was watching these documentaries, I was seeing how once they released the arrow, yeah, the bow would flip. And yeah, it made me think, wow, they must have this, you know, obviously firm grip, but at the point of the release, they must sort of slightly let it go. And I was sort of wondering, why do they do that?
Yeah, so you're not allowed to let go. You have to keep your grip exactly the same. And this is the thing. Yeah, so it has to be the correct application of force in order to turn. As the arrow leaves,
I see.
The force of the string coming back turns the bow, not you turning the bow. So there's yugaeri, which is the turning correctly, or yugaishi, which is you flipping it. So it's very, that will pass and fail you in an exam for kudo.
Okay.
Yeah, they're very, it's very detailed and difficult, but yes, it's very interesting, that one specific aspect of it.
Yeah, I just watched that documentary and found out how difficult gradings are. And there's one man who's trying to reach, I think it's eighth dan. Done it, I think he's had 16, he's tried for 16 years. And even though he's incredibly good at hitting the target, there's something about his form that's, you know, lacking. But he's so happy and enthusiastic about the challenge that he's doesn't seem to be discouraged by not passing, you know, after 16 years. So
yeah, I think he was trying for Hachidan. Is it eighth dan?
Yeah, Hachidan. Yeah, eighth dan. Yeah.
Yeah. So just to give it a bit of, and sort of a, how can I say, context, because Hachidan, probably listening, people listening have no idea what that even is. But Shodan, the first there's the first and lowest that you get sort of within a year of starting, and then there's up to 10th. And the people that get 9th or 10th, sometimes it's posthumous. Like, that's how long it takes.
I see.
So 8 is sort of like you're one of the highest ranked people probably in your area. And after Hachidan, you can be a Hanshi. You can try for Hanshi, which is like a master. So it's very, very high up in the scale of the Kyudo ranking. So 8th is like pretty much where everything stops, because after that it's CSAM, which is recommendations. Recommendations to be given the title. There's no actual grading for it. So he was going for that. It's the last grading of Kyudo. So if you can imagine, it's just like, so yeah, I mean, but yeah, like you mentioned, the lifelong pursuit of that. And I would say it probably wasn't the be all and end all for him. Like, getting it is just something that would put the cherry on the cake as such of his wonderful work that he had been doing for his life. So he's quite a famous teacher and very well loved in the Kyudo community. But yes, it's a very interesting movie, that one. Oh, documentary it was, yeah?
Yeah. It's so well shot and so respectful to Kyudo. So a few themes came up, and I wrote probably wrote about 10 bullet points here, and we don't have to look at all of them. But one thing I loved was one of the people being interviewed said, you know, hara, like you've got to shoot from your belly, or aim the target with your belly, which would probably sound quite unusual for our listeners. So would you like to touch on that?
Yeah, it sounds like something an eighth dan person would say, because I'm third dan, so I'm still not anywhere near using my body correctly. I mean, it's been 6 years. However, we need to shoot using tanden, which is the space around our groin area. So doing the ashibumi, or setting the feet correctly, works to balance the upward part of our body. So Kyudo is really all about balance and making the balance of top and bottom and left and right as you release the arrow. And if you're unbalanced, the arrow goes in a really weird place. However, using the stomach or tanden, we can just say hara, it helps to lower the center of gravity and to help the arrow fly better. So it's it's a thing that beginners have really big trouble doing, because switching on one part of your body when you're like trying to shoot something, you have to be quite dexterous. And it's the sort of thing that eighth dan level people, they need to be doing it as a matter of course. Like, it's a tarimae. However, me, I'm still trying to find my tanden. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like it just opens you up to this incredible world, and you're learning all this jargon and technique, but there's this inner perspective. So there is this other theme they talked about, hitting by chance and then moving towards true striking. So would you like to touch on that, and maybe you can share where you feel you're at on that scale?
Yes. So if you check, theoretically, if your technique, but isha, what is it? Isha hichu is the means in Japanese that if your technique is correct, your arrow will hit the target. So that is sort of one of the big, one of the big themes that comes through with Kyudo in general, no matter what the school of archery is, because they vary from school to school, the different things that they look for and are searching for as practitioners. However, what was I going to say? I think that hitting the target can be done by anybody in any way. If you're just cool with standing there and like flicking the arrow over, that's fine. However, for grading, it must be performed to that specific archery schools. They have their different things, their checklist. Mm-hmm. And if you want to do grading and you want to get shodan, you need to be moving, walking, standing, sitting, and shooting in a specific way. So if you cannot do that, you do not advance up in the ranks, unfortunately. So shodan and second dan, nidan, you don't need to hit. However, you need to demonstrate that you know the correct way to walk and stand. You'll be in a group with four other people and you shoot in order. You stand and sit down. And you stand and shoot and then sit down, and the person behind you stands and shoots. So it's all timed. So you need to be in coordination with four other people. The timing is important. And then you need to show that you understand the hasetsu, the different kata.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to hit. So this is for shodan and nidan. From third dan, you need to be hitting at least one arrow. So consciously, you need to be aiming with your eyes, like archery. So yes, there's very like conscious aiming involved. And you need to be consciously trying to hit that target because it's for third dan, you need to get at least one. Fourth dan, some people pass with one arrow, but you basically need to be hitting two. From fourth down onwards. So everybody needs to be hitting. And hitting needs to be coming from correct use of technique, not hitting because you're good at aiming. So it's a very tricky balance between technique and aiming. So this is where the sort of the interesting part lies. Archery too, though, Western archery, I do field archery, bare bow, recurve. Mm-hmm. And technique is important as well. And it's not like super easy, like everybody says, oh, kudo is difficult compared to archery. Well, depends on what kind of archery you do, but bare bow is very similar to kudo in some senses of body movement. Yeah.
Yeah, that was interesting in the documentary. I was aware of the term waza, which is technique, but came across this word taihai, which must be form, what you've just talked about.
Yeah.
And the way you walk and kneel and your posture. And I think in the documentary, at certain schools, they start with people learning without releasing an arrow and they just practice arrowless. They're just practicing with a bow. And I think it's like a test to see if they'll give up. And they're sort of weeding out the people who aren't taking it seriously enough. Mm. So that was interesting. And then there appears to be no time limit when once you're integrating or practicing. You don't have to be shooting within a minute or something.
I don't think so. For competitions, there is a time limit.
Okay.
Yep. However, for grading, so the shooting for competitions and the shooting for grading is quite different in terms of technique. Grading, yes, you mentioned tai hai. So we're in there with four other members and our timing is controlled by the front person's breathing, which is like, hi, if I'm at the back, I cannot hear you breathing. So it's, you know, it's like Chinese whispers. Can I say the word? It's like the whisper game where the story needs to be passed down correctly and in time until the back person comes in together and they all move and walk in the same coordinated movements and everything. So the way you breathe is sets the pace for everything. But yeah, please remind me, sorry, of what we were just talking about.
That's all right. That's fine.
I've like gone off on a tangent.
That's all right. We're just talking about time limits and whatnot. But
time limits, time limits. But basically, you can, that kai, that full draw, when that feeling of fullness, when you're supposed to be letting go of everything, you have no worries in your mind, you're just concentrating on your breathing and expanding, using the hala, using your stomach and your kanden, expanding up and down and left and right, the arrow will release naturally. Yeah, this is the length of the kai and the length of your full draw. You're not stopping, so it's not holding it. It's just how long you can expand until you explode kind of thing. Yeah, this part is timed. There's no time limit on it really. However, if it's too short, that's a problem. So people will just bring the arrow down and then let go straight away. They're not taking time to expand in that last final stage of the shooting. So it's a bit of a waste kind of thing. But yeah, how many seconds? And when you get to fifth dan, people say like should be 5 seconds for fifth dan and 6 seconds for sixth dan and all this kind of thing. They have these sort of standards of how long you should be expanding and, you know, stretching out your body for, which is quite interesting.
It is interesting, and I was wondering how difficult is it to draw or to achieve full draw? I see some people, when I watch some videos, you know, there's fatigue and they're sort of shaking, and then other people who, you know, weren't that big and didn't seem that strong, didn't seem to be in fatigue. So, yeah, how hard is it to do a full draw, and how much weight are we talking about?
Yeah, so the bow itself is measured in kilos, so very different to other styles of archery that are measured in pounds. So we measure in kilos and they start at 6, which is a beginner's bow, and they go up to like 50 maybe, which like probably only a handful of people can draw a 50 kilo bow. So about 100 pounds for people. Yeah. And they're like, it's like a monster. Like it's thick, really thick. And it's like a war bow pretty much. And so we start off at about 6 or 7 if you're a beginner practitioner, because we use muscles that you've never used before. So compared to archery, where the draw is up under your chin, the draw with kudo is back behind your ear around the back of your head. So that wide draw really switches on different sort of muscles. So even if you've done archery, if you start kudo, you figure out quite quickly that you have to drop your bow weight probably to compared to what you use on a recurve. And the whole technique is up really high and then wide and big. So you are expanding and it's very wide and large. So we start off with weaker bows and go up. But bows are rated to the person's ability. So that's why you'll see some people who are, they might be shaking in that full draw. However, you'll have other beginners who are just like, it seems to be quite easy and they're opening it up and letting go very freely. So yeah, everybody's bows are different weights.
I see. That makes sense now. I see this 6th Dan or 7th Dan and he's got a lot of fatigue. And then there's beginners like seemingly, so flawlessly or easily pull this bow back. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah. How's that so? So now I know. So thank you.
No worries.
So let's maybe touch on this idea. It's spiritual concentration. And it seems like, in short, you know, there's a lot of technique, a lot of preparation goes into releasing a single arrow. And, yeah, I think some of our listeners who are familiar with Japanese martial arts will understand that it's perhaps to help you prepare and calm the mind so you don't have these crazy thoughts or uncontrollable thoughts, which there's a Japanese word for zatsunen. So, yeah, is that what you've discovered, that through this practice you lose those, that the monkey mind where you're bouncing from thought to thought and you are able to concentrate?
I had never heard it's the first time to read that word, so I had to look it up. Yeah, I've never heard it before. But things like mushin, which is empty mind, empty heart, munen muso, and mushin. Mushin is used a lot in martial arts, so that's just an empty mind. However, as still a beginner, I say this even after 6 years, I'm still a beginner. Obviously, you know, shoshin, which is the beginner's mind. We're all beginners up until we pass away. We learn something new every day, no matter if we are 90 or 0 years old. However, having the beginner's mind, you're always thinking about something new. And to give a bit of an example, I'm constantly trying to improve my technique. So I'm thinking about something consciously every practice that I go to, every okeiko. However, what I'm thinking about in the dojo and as I'm shooting are things related to what I'm doing at that moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you imagine if I step back into my everyday life and the things that I have on, work, children, all this other kind of stuff, I can step away from it when I step into the dojo. So in this sense, I really leave that busy, hectic, tiring, challenging, don't want to be too negative, but, you know, the realities of everyday life, it's a wonderful life. However, stepping out of that world, that sphere, and stepping into the sphere of this dojo that is hugely quiet and the smell and there's grass in front of me, it's peaceful. What I see with my eyes, the visual picture never changes. So in that sense, it provides a lot of stability visually and also for me mentally. The people that are there are always the same. The actions that I perform are largely the same. Those hasetsu, those 8 different kata, those 8 different movements. And having that repetition and that similarity, that familiarity, the smell, the people, everything is the same. Having this very calm, quiet environment for self-reflection, communication with other people, my own little world, if I can say, my own community, that really provides a sort of a mental oasis and a physical oasis for me to really refresh and step out of my everyday life. So I used to be a runner. Like I used to run several times a week, go on marathons and stuff. However, once I started keto, I started running less and less. And I realized that keto was taking on that role of stress relief and really providing a refreshing sort of time of the day for me, time to do introspection and forget about the outside stresses. And I found myself running less and less to the point where I've given up. Obviously, my body has changed a lot. I've gotten really strong arms thanks to keto. However, and, you know, running is great cardio. I love it. So, yeah, I really tell myself I should get back into running, actually. But for that, the body and the mind part of it and your heart and your soul, it's really like my cup is so full because of studying keto. And it's really difficult as everybody has different feelings about keto and how it affects them positively. But for me, yeah, it's really been a wonderful thing for my concentration and my health, both mentally and physically. It's really allowed me then, after I finish my practice and I step back into that hectic world, it's really allowed me and given me the tools to calmly and, how can I say, really just be a calm and a nicer person. And obviously having different, getting Japanese skills, getting skills of etiquette and how to bow to people and how to interact with Japanese people in my everyday life. So many good points that I've learned and can bring with me into my everyday life too. So it's like really overlaps and feeds into each other. So it's just getting better and better kind of thing as I'm continuing on with keto. It's really providing me with new skills and things that will help me in my everyday life too.
Yeah, I mean, you love it so much that you said this on, I think on the NHK video, that you find it so wonderful that you want to share it with the world and Japan. And yes, you founded your own dojo, which we'll touch on in a minute. But in addition to keto, you're actually doing something I guess we could describe as sports equestrian archery, sports yabusame. And when I saw you do that, I thought, wow, this is pretty dangerous. So would you like to talk about what yabusame is? And yeah, it must be lots of fun.
Yes, but I mean, every country, so they have their own equestrian archery, their own horseback archery culture. And Japan too has horseback archery culture. So the type of yabusame I do, there are two types. So I do the type which is purely for fun and enjoyment in a sport. And it's called sports yabusame. So it's a little different to the one that is performed at Shinto shrines as a prayer and a blessing or a wish. Mm-hmm. And that is performed by, yes, that's performed by practitioners who undergo a long shugyo, so a very long period of training under a certain archery school. So my type of yabusame, it uses the same equipment, the traditional old style. Sometimes we ride on antique saddles and stirrups. And the horses used for sports yabusame are Japanese horses. So we call them washuma, which are indigenous to Japan. So the other type of yabusame, they use a mix of washuma, so the Japanese horse, and non-Japanese breeds. So non-Japanese breeds are very long racehorse style thoroughbreds, and they're very, very fast. So that's one thing that's quite different. The Japanese horses about 135 or 40 centimeters tall, so like a pony class of horse. And so the speeds are, the top speeds of a thoroughbred compared to a Japanese horse are slightly different. However, I think a Japanese horse top speed is 40 kilometers an hour, which is pretty fast. That's enough for me. But yeah, the type of archery the sports yabusame I do is just having that mix of indigenous horse and traditional horse tack, and the riding style is Washiki Bajutsu, which is Japanese style equestrianism mixed with the sport of horseback archery. So you have to hit and you get points, and this nice blend of traditional culture, indigenous horses, and the sport means that everybody can enjoy it. And you can start from the first day when you come and visit the horse ranch. They'll pop you on a horse, they'll teach you all the different techniques that you need to know, and it's Yabusame for everyone. So everybody can try it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome. I might try that next time in Japan.
I think you should.
Yeah, okay. Well, I didn't realize that it was so free and open and flexible because it's, I guess, traditional yabusame is quite dangerous, yeah, and people have
been
seriously injured or even died from falling off a horse. Yeah, I was like, wow, just because doing that as well. So I thought that was amazing. But it must be lots of fun. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. The traditional yabusame, I got to see it finally for the first time in Nikko this year in Tochigi. And yes, very, very fast. And the practitioners are highly skilled and trained for years and years before getting on a horse and debuting. They call it debut. So they'll make their debut at the Yabusame Shinji, which is their prayer ceremony for the Shinto shrine. So I have a lot of respect for them because they have dedicated their life to the practice of their art, which is Yabusame. So it's not just a fun little hobby for them or anything like that. It's sort of they live and breathe horses and equestrianism. And yeah, I did write an article on a wonderful Australian guy that I met. And he honestly, he's just, horse whisperer. He's super amazing. Michael Noor, and his article is up that I wrote. But yeah, people like this are just fabulous and continuing on that tradition of Japanese equestrianism and the yabusame spirit and everything through to the next generation of people. So hopefully, it will continue and keep going. And it's a very beautiful and art, and the horses are super fast.
Awesome. Yeah. Speaking of tradition, let's move on to craftsmanship, which I know you love. So can you talk about the craftsmanship of the bows, the long bows? I know they're the longest bows, I think, in the world in terms of obviously length in archery. And I learned that in Japanese, it's nanashaku gosun, like 2.25 meters long. So that's pretty long.
Yeah.
And, things like temperature will influence the pull force, and I think hemp strings are used. But I did know that I think you have to be a certain dan before you're using bamboo or wooden bows, and before that you use carbon fiber. So would you like to touch on that?
Yeah, sure. So the bow, the Japanese bow or yumi, is very interesting for me, and I take time to research it, and you'll see lots of different posts on social media about the bow itself. So bows and bow culture in Japan, it's obviously very long history, and they historically have been from very small to very big. So there are many different sizes of bow depending on the application. And for kudo, we use the daikyu, which is the long one, and usually the sizes are over 2 meters. So the way we choose the length of the bow relates to the length of our arm, which is our draw length. Our arrows are that long from our neck to our fingertips, past a little bit more. And the length that you can draw sort of determines the size of the bow. So very big boys and big women have longer bows because, their height is also a factor and their arm length is also a factor. Yeah, so I shoot nami sun, which is, I think, 221 centimeters. And then the materials are just usually three main materials, and that is glass fiber, that's Japanese. Grass fiber. I forget. They switch it around. Fiberglass bows, which are sort of the entry level and the standard one that you'll get when you're a beginner. There's carbon, which is lighter, a little bit more expensive. The manufacturing process is a little bit different. And then the one that the craftsman needs to make, which is the take yumi. So that's a bamboo bow. And they're very labor intensive. The parts that need to be put together like a sandwich to make this bow, some of them have to dry for several years before they can be used. So I've taken part in cutting bamboo for going to be used for yumi. And that was a really big learning experience having those nodes, making sure they're at the right length. They carry this huge ruler that you put up against the bamboo, and it's a specific sort of bamboo. And then you have to be very careful when you cut it, because even squashing it in the wrong way bruises it. And these kind of bruises and things come out after they've taken the time to dry it. They'll get a mark or something on the bamboo, and that's not allowed. So we were joking, like, that would take time. I would have cut something, they'll take time, stripped it all, and they split it into four. And this one has a bruise. This will be one that Jessica's cut for us, because it's like it's like really bummed up. And I'm like, yeah. So but the whole experience was really fabulous. Even just the cutting, it's done at a certain time of the year. It's done by certain people. The craftsperson is involved in that, and they have very specific things that they look for. And I was just like, wow, this is so cool. And I cut arrow bamboo as well. And then you have four arrows, so you need to find four matching pieces of bamboo, which is just like, I can't imagine. Anyway, so the bow is made of bamboo with wooden inserts and carbon inside it for some people. So you have carbon insert bamboo, and you have different slices of wood, and then bamboo in the middle. The type of glue that they use denotes separate types of yumi or bow as well. So yeah, the whole process is very labor intensive. There is one craftsman called Kanjiro Shibata, and he has a wonderful Instagram, and he's put the whole process up. Like, you'll have reels and reels of him and his son who are making these beautiful bows in Kyoto. And I got to go visit him actually earlier this year, and it was really eye-opening. Like, it's for some people, it makes them want one even more. But for me, I just got so scared, because I'm like, look how much work and passion, and it's just like they live and breathe making them. And actually, there, Shibata-san is a Kyudo teacher as well. So he goes overseas. He's in America at the moment. He's gone to France a couple of weeks back, and he teaches his style of archery to everybody around the world. So he's making these bows in Kyoto, and then he's also teaching Kyudo. Sorry, it was just a bit of off tangent there.
No, but great.
Meeting these wonderful people that are so passionate about their art, I'm just like, oh, I'm too scared to order one now, because obviously the price reflects the amount of time that goes into it. So it takes several months and years, if you include drying the materials, to make it. And then you'll see them, their labor of love. And it's just like, wow, imagine if I had one, and then, being me, I'd end up breaking it or something. So bamboo is very susceptible to moisture and the air and dryness. And my sensei says that they're living, they're really like, summer here is very humid. You have to take into account the humidity. And then in winter, the dryness, you need to be aware of the temperature of the day. The bow itself tires, so you can only shoot a certain amount of shots for some bows. And so there's quite a stringent way to maintain the bow, and when you're using it, the correct way to use it. And if you use it with incorrect technique over time, you'll find it will just snap. So I'm like, oh my goodness, imagine spending like thousands on a bow only to have it snap on you. And so my sensei said, I've snapped so many. And I'm just like, okay. But, and sometimes it's not your fault. Sometimes it's a defect in the work. However, yeah, just I would be crying, mate, honestly, if I spent thousands on that. Yeah, but for now, I'm saving my money and kind of waiting to see. I've been given permission to get a bamboo bow, which is very nice. I'm on the 6-year mark, and I've finally been given permission to get one that's got carbon in it. So the shape won't change too much. The carbon helps keep the shape of the bow. So it's like a beginner's bamboo bow. So it's nice. But in terms of which dan you can get the bow at, some schools of archery and some dojo, they ask you to buy one after you've passed shodan. So the first grading, just to get you used to the maintenance and get you used to shooting with one, because the feeling shooting a bamboo bow is very soft, and it's very different. It's very kind to your body. However, it's quite different to a carbon or a fiberglass bow. Yeah, so some dojos prefer to get people used to that very early on. However, it is expensive. It's one of the things. My dojo, it's just up to what my teacher says. So I do remember asking him several times, like especially after passing one grading, I'll be like, so is it okay if I go buy one? And he'll be like, yeah, Yeah, I don't think it's a good idea yet. And I'm like, okay. So I usually just do what he says. He's very well versed in everything, and he can see like the way I should, and he watches me every day. So I really trust his judgment. And if he's kind of like, you know, why spend thousands if you're just going to end up breaking it?
Yeah.
So it's like, well, actually, yeah, when you put it that way, I'm not in a big hurry to get one, to be honest. However, it's what I'm aiming for. And it's nice to have that goal, like, in the future ahead of me. Yeah. I think when I get one, I'll finally feel like I'm like real. It's like a true keto practitioner, if you know what I mean. Yeah. It's weird, but
it's worth the wait, and you've earned it, I guess. You'll have that feeling.
Yes.
And I mean, maybe that's also a way to perhaps also appreciate the crafts.
Yes.
Personship. And yeah, I'm like you. I just find it amazing how these crafts, men and women, can dedicate their whole life to one craft. And we're talking, you know, 70 years in some cases, or maybe even longer. And I just don't know how many people would have the spirit, the heart, and the concentration to do that, you know, basically every day of their life.
They have issues recently where people are less and less wanting to take over or become the next generation of craftspeople in Japan, which is one of the reasons why I do try to actively, when I meet somebody that is a craftsperson or an artisan, I do actively try to help them out a little bit, promote them, or, you know, write about them if I can. As I understand, you know, the next generation, I kind of ask, you know, do you have a deshi, somebody who's going to be coming in to take over after you are finished or you have to retire? And many of the times people say no, which is really heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And they're not quite, you know, I don't know. I think depending on the industry, the area that they work in, advertising for somebody is not really done. And yeah, they don't actively search out. They want people to be, to have that, you know, the want desire and the need, and the feeling and the interest in it to be actively coming to them, which I understand. However, a lot of the times then nobody comes, which is like really sad. So yeah, this kind of thing is one sort of the back and the negative aspect of it, which is unfortunate. And then the other day I met a wonderful American man who has become a katsushi, which is an armor, a traditional armor craftsperson, artisan. Yeah, and so he's trained as an archaeologist, and he came to Japan on jet, and he found by chance, he was introduced to a man, Miura-san, who is a katsushi. So he makes traditional and fixes sort of like the treasures, national treasures of Japan. So their armor, which is a really high, high, amazing position. Yeah, and he met with him, and over time, he really felt like he wanted to start and be himself. So he underwent the shugyo, the training period, and now he's the person who is taking on. Miura-san passed away, unfortunately, but he's taken on the legacy and the name and all the skills that this craftsperson has. So I like this idea that this Miura-san was open to the idea that a non-Japanese person could take and pass on the tradition of and all the different skills. So I really like this because in the artisan world, in the craftsperson world in Japan, probably you and I have a really big feeling that it's like all Japanese people.
Yeah.
I think it's very commendable and interesting that they are interested and open to having people who, no matter what their nationality is, if they're passionate about it and they want to continue the tradition. I just thought it was so cool. So yeah, he's a very unique guy, but it's interesting that, you know, kind of reaching out and having non-Japanese people is also an option for some craftspeople and artisans.
Yeah, I saw I think it was on Japanology Japan, a craftsman who made knives was in this similar situation, and he couldn't find a deshi, or a deshi wouldn't approach him. And then, yeah, I think it was another American who he went to his shop, and he was just a student in Japan and had all these questions. And then I think 2 years later, he came back to the shop and said, oh, I'd like to learn. And the master was great. And that's, you know, that start. And now he's really skilled at making these beautiful knives. And I thought that's wonderful that they're open to sharing this incredible craft that they could lose if they don't find someone. that they're willing to share it to foreigners. And as you say, I think a lot of people would have the perception they just, you know, they wouldn't do that. So that is, that's a beautiful thing. So
yeah, I think so.
Well, let's talk about another beautiful thing, which is your Kudo Club or school, which you co-founded. So, do you want to talk about how it's, I think it's quite unique, and I think next time I'm in Japan, I might roll up and see if I can take a lesson. So,
Definitely.
So, tell me about you, me, and Zen.
Okay, so the club was founded about 4 years ago, and the name You, Me, and Zen is kind of interesting. One man called Roy. Roy chose the name for us, and he loves Dajire, which is like a play on words. And You, Me is obviously the Japanese bo, Yumi, but in our English name, it's You and Me and Zen. So the whole idea is that it's for you and me and everyone. And that's the reason for the name. More than, we get quite a lot of, it's the name of that book, but it's kind of, and we weren't actively trying to take the title or anything like that, but it's more like an all-encompassing you and me. But the club started 4 years ago, and we're based in Tokyo and Kitaku and Akabane. And we started with just kind of a couple of people that were interested in doing Kudo. And I myself had a bit of an experience where I couldn't do Kudo due to that youngest child being hospitalized and then me having to go back to New Zealand for a little period of time and not being able to do Kudo. It was hard to find a dojo that would accept these long absences without, you know, thinking I'm not serious about Kudo.
Okay.
So I was in a position where I hadn't done Kudo for about 9 months. And I met with Hiro-san, and he's the other person. He's the person that runs the dojo. So I do not run it. So Hiro is the owner and the person that runs it, and I'm the helper, sort of the second in charge, and he's the first in charge. So Hiro also had been going through personal stuff, and he'd just moved house, and he was looking for Kudo. He'd sort of stepped back from it for about a couple of months due to not having a regular place to go and several different reasons. So we were both sort of up in the air with our training and our practice. And then we had other people talking to us saying they'd like to learn. And we found this wonderful dojo that you can book for sessions as long as you register with them. So we thought, hey, how about if we do like a weekly session, then at least we'll be able to practice once a week. And it's a place where we'll be the deciders of what you have to wear and what you have to do and all the rules and this kind of thing. So there's no federation in this dojo as such. So there's a lot less, how can I say, physical and mental pressure and like things to conform to. Forgetting my English. So that's the reason why we started, just due out of necessity and then people asking us. And 4 years later, we've had, I think, 29 different countries, people from 29 different countries, and hundreds and thousands of people joining us over the time. And it's been really successful. However, he works a full-time job and then I have my own stuff. So this is kind of our labor of love, our passion, if you will, is introducing Kudo to other people and showing people that Kudo isn't as scary as people think scary, or there's quite a large hurdle for starting it. It's difficult to join beginner classes as they don't have them often, only once a year. And the beginner class numbers are very low, maybe 10 people for every 150 applicants. So it's very difficult to start Kudo in Japan as an adult. But other people who practiced in high school and it's been 30 years and they'd like to try to start again, but going to their local is a bit daunting, and they want to just like ease into it and get used to doing it again and then transfer over to their local dojo. Or you have people who are having interpersonal issues at their own dojo and they just want a space where they can like chill out and just shoot and do their own thing to balance their life out a bit. So we have lots of different people from lots of different backgrounds, and Hiro speaks English and I speak English, and obviously we speak Japanese. So we're available and open for people to come and try anytime they like. And you can just come with yourself. So we have bows and we have the hakama, which is the uniform and the dogi, the things mm-hmm. you wear, and the arrows and the gloves. We have everything. We bring it to the dojo every week in my car and we set it all up and we set up the targets. So it's a bit time consuming. However, it's nice to be able to provide. Just some people just want to try once, you know, they're only in Japan for a week. Can I please try?
Awesome.
And the cool thing is when you get people like that, like they want to continue. And so we check out on the internet. Kudo is in over, nice. I think, like 36 countries in the world anyway. Australia has a lot of different places and New Zealand too. So they're pleasantly surprised when they go home to find out that there's a dojo actually like down the road from them that practices once a week. And so they end up joining in their own country, which I just love. Like, that's so cool. Yeah, so I get a lot of cool stories like that. Yeah, it's a once a week practice that my friend, Hiro-san, and he's the teacher, he and I both run. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. You make it so accessible to anyone and everyone.
Yeah.
And when I was watching a video of you again and thinking, oh, wow, she's co-founded this dojo, I thought, this reminds me of this sub-theory of ikigai, and it's another one of these amazing sort of Japanese words where it's, you know, used casually, but now it's become this term related to, I guess, psychology or positive psychology, and it's ibasho,
yes,
which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes. And
it sort of now means a place where you can feel comfortable, safe and secure, where you have these human connections and relationships, a place of empowerment and a place where you can self-actualize. So it sounds like that your club is an ibasho, a place for someone to be, but also learn and grow.
Yeah.
So would you say it is ibasho open to everyone?
I think it depends on the person. But ibasho, yes, our club can be an ibasho. For me, kudo itself is an ibasho. So the kudo community, and not just my dojo, but the dojo that I practice at every day, which is in Saitama, that's really my ibasho. However, I can see that coming to visit Yumi and Zen, the person who just comes for our once a week practices, I can see how it would be an ibasho. Ibasho is very, very, very important. As a non-Japanese person living in Japan for 21 years, I really realized, like, after I started, that I had gained this community of elders, so we can say senpai, and also kohai, so younger people underneath me, that especially for the elders, the senpai, getting advice, and, you know, not just for things related to kudo, any types of advice, being away from my parents living in New Zealand. And my father passed away just before Corona started. So, you know, losing a parent and then not having close connections with older people and older generations, really respect. It's to have a sounding board of like, what would you do? Or what do you think? And especially having them as Japanese people, like they're the people that are living in this society and have lived. So having this knowledge and amazing, that's one really big thing that gave me ibasho. And then we all have a shared interest, you know, and I think that's nice, having a little community. Maybe people that don't know about ibasho just maybe think, like, do you have a community, do you have a hobby, and your community that you've grown, that you all love the same thing, and you have relationships perhaps out of the hobby, you meet up and it's given you friendship and support and all this kind of thing. Yeah, I think having an ibasho is very important, and it helps to, it feeds into your daily life and just helps to make you whole.
It's another amazing word, just, you know, defining or exploring this concept. Then I actually had another podcast where the guest talked about how bonsai clubs were this ibasho, and there were these bonsai clubs all over the world, and as you would know, these bonsai trees, they're very precious to the owner, where in some cases people won't travel overseas because they're worried that their tree will die. And in some cases they do entrust the bonsai to another member of this ibasho because they know they'll look after it. So yeah, I love that idea that you can have a e-bashal built around a craft or a hobby or a sport.
Yeah.
But we should start wrapping up. And I think what I've learned from, you know, watching you on video and on social media and through talking with you today is that you have embraced Japan, really embraced it, and, you know, living there for 20 years. But it seems very much that Japan has embraced you. But I imagine, you know, it hasn't been easy and that you've had many struggles while living in Japan. So I don't want to end on a pessimistic note, and we won't. But, yeah, would you like to touch on any struggles and perhaps Kudo has helped you overcome them or get through them?
Yeah. let me have a think. Kudo, it'll be indirectly because Kudo could, yeah, since starting Kudo, I haven't really had anything notably negative. I try not to bring or let negative energy into my life. I'm very about having boundaries and keeping my space realistic and positive and moving forwards. I don't like to dwell on bad things that happen to me. I'm not the kind of person that, what is it, have a chip on their shoulder and like, that person's such a dick. And I honestly, like, as soon as something happens to me, I build a bridge and I get over it because I'm the sort of person that doesn't, yeah, it's just a waste of energy and time, to be honest, if negative things happen. So that's just like my mindset, just nice. To give you that little insight. So when you say if anything's happened, I've probably forgotten about it. However, a big challenge for me, which I like to call a challenge instead, having a child with special needs and giving birth to a child with special needs and then working within the medical system to get a diagnosis, because for the longest time, the first 3 years, they getting that diagnosis and then the support, which there's a lot of support. You just need to have the diagnosis and you need to jump through those hoops and that kind of thing. So that was a lot of new Japanese and sort of medical system related things that I had no experience with, even though I had two other children, staying in the hospital and their rules and all this kind of thing. It was a lot of learning and a lot of, especially for the first sort of 5 years of her life. And but having Kudo, even though I have all these different challenges with my younger child, having Kudo has really brought balance to my life. So it's really provided me with a space that I can spend time with myself and with other people in that e-basho in the dojo. And then, yeah, it's given me balance, basically. So even though it is stressful, she's a great kid. She's a wonderful and beautiful little angel. However, it is physically hard and it can be mentally hard and this kind of thing, having a child with special needs. As people who are listening, if they have, you know, if they know someone with special needs or if they have a child with special needs themselves, it has its own special set of challenges. But, yeah, having those two really balances each other out. And, yeah, I'm glad that I've found Kudo and I've continued with Kudo and it's given me so much more than I ever expected, really, to be honest. And then, you know, passing those wonderful things and good things on to everybody else is what sort of has sort of come of it. Yeah. So
love it. Well, related to what you just said, that last line is this yochijukugo, like a four kanji character expression. And yeah, I love yochijukugo. And it's shasoku jinsei. And would you like to share what that means and if you believe that's the case? Yeah.
I had to look it up. So I think it's just one shot, one life, right?
Yeah. Okay, yeah. That's one interpretation, or Kudo is life. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it depends on the Kudo school. However, ours is Shinzenbi is a different one. So it's not really Yojijukugo. But the Yojijukugo that I really like are Nanakorobi Aoki, which is fall down seven times and get up eight. And also I like Junin Toiro, which is 10 people, 10 colors. Yeah, so they're not related to Kudo. However, they are applicable to Kudo. You know, working with challenges and never giving up and just moving forwards, the idea about being positive and having positive movement and forwards movement in your life. And also the Junin Toiro, which is everybody's different, and accepting people. You know, and this is coming from Japan, which is supposed to be this very, you know, just one culture and everybody's Japanese or everybody looks the same. However, they have this wonderful saying, which is Junin Toiro. So they understand the insides of people 10 people are going to be feeling different, 10 different ways about things, which I really love. So this open and accepting to differences. So that was, the Kudo one. And in particular, I have heard of it. However, I myself haven't really researched into it. However, just, especially journeying Toiro is really one that strikes a chord with me personally.
Yeah, I learned that one in Ken Moggi's book. And the way he described it, he said it so poetically. I think that all of us have a unique personality. We have unique sensitivity and perspective. And that's sort of something to be embraced. Mm-hmm. And, you can learn so much from Japanese and Japanese culture and Japanese people. And I've learned a lot from you today, Jessica. So thank you so much for your time. And I'll have to come and visit your dojo and catch up with you in person on my next trip to Tokyo. So before we finish, how can people connect or best find you or find your work?
Yes. So I will send a Linktree link, and that has everything. My main thing, I think, is Instagram at the moment, but I'm on every social media, so Twitter and Facebook and TikTok and LinkedIn too, obviously, for the business friends. And, YouTube a little bit here and there. And my YouTube and Instagram handles and everything, it's all Jess in Tokyo in one word. So if you just search up Jess in Tokyo, then I'll pop up. And, I just put daily life in there on the stories and things related to Kudo and different activities that I do in Japan. So please come and have a look.
We'll put all that in the show notes so people can. And, thank you so much. It was, a real joy. And I'm so glad you had the time to spend an hour and a half with me today.
No, it's been my pleasure. It's wonderful to talk about Ikigai with you.
I usually end my podcast with, what's your ikigai? But we all know what it is. So so thanks, Jess.
Yeah, my pleasure.
This episode was brought to you by the Find Your Ikigai course. Developed in consultation with Japan's leading ikigai researchers, the Find Your Ikigai course is the only culturally accurate and evidence-based practical guide to the ikigai concept. To learn more about the Find Your Ikigai course, please visit ikigaitribe.com.